tragedy, and potentially hope, next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
As always, Barry, I'm really glad to be here with you today. We have some important things to talk about, so hopefully somebody out there is listening and we're not just doing this, sending it out to the open air. But we know that's not the case because we know people listen to it, at least online for sure. And we know WLRY has a loyal hearership because people contact us from time to time. And I'm going to give people the chance to do that. First of all, go to www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And you can contact us and you can tell us what you think of the things that we say. And we don't get too much negative feedback. We do occasionally, and that's fine. We're big boys. We can take it.
Well, you're right. We can. And but remember, too, we also dish it out.
Well, that's right.
No, I'm just kidding about we that. Do. You know, we're willing to take criticism and think about things from different perspectives because we're supposed to be doing that now, aren't we, Chuck?
Oh, absolutely. We're supposed to be doing that. In fact, if we're not doing self-examination from time to time about our motivations and about the things that are happening, then we have descended into a place that's not a good place.
And that's the thing is, and I look at this because we've got a lot of things going on, but, you know, what I want to start with is the fact that, Chuck, as you know, we record in this program airs on Saturdays, and this week, after our program's over with, come Monday, we, in some parts of the country, celebrate a holiday or observe it, and for the vast majority of us, it's called Columbus Day because we are observing and recognizing the discovery of the Americas. And I say it that way because, as we know, Columbus didn't necessarily land on the U.S. main continent, but he's credited with the discovery of the Americas, which is the basically Western Hemisphere part of the world that most people in the Eastern Hemisphere thought that you fell off a map if you sailed that direction. So we celebrate that, but even that has risen to the level of being a controversial thing, Chuck. I mean, I don't know if there's anything out there that we could possibly, you know, look at. Maybe perhaps Mother's Day, but then, of course, that may get changed as well with some of the transgender movement going on. But when we look at that, I mean, right now we have a big issue. There was a big dust-up in the city of Cincinnati just this week because the mayor and one of the city council members was upset because council refused to actually entertain and debate and discuss a motion to change the name of Columbus Day for the city of Cincinnati to Indigenous Peoples Day. And, okay, that's all fine and well, folks. I mean, you know, we get right down to it. The fact is that the vast majority of those people wanting to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day, which is really a progressive leftist move to try to obliterate our culture, our heritage, and our history, frankly, if it weren't for Columbus and others coming, they wouldn't be sitting in Cincinnati to complain about Columbus Day. Without the finding, of course, it would have happened sooner or later, but by the providential course of history, Christopher Columbus, and we call him Columbus, it's actually, I think it's Christopher Colon.
Yes, Cristobal Colon. Yeah, it's
had a great idea to petition the King and Queen of Spain to finance a trip for him so he could find a different route for getting spices from the Indies. That's really what the trip was supposedly about, and it just so happens that he decided to sail west instead of sailing east around the Horn of Africa, which was a dangerous trek, and he sailed to the west and came into the Indies, and West Indies, not the East Indies, and of course along up through Hispaniola and other places of that nature, and up and found the greater Western Hemisphere landmass, which, obviously, we don't call it Columbia anymore. It wasn't named after Columbus.
Columbia, the gem of the ocean, right. Yeah,
that's right. It was actually named after another explorer, Amerigo Vespucci, who I think was also a map maker, and I think wrote his
name on it, yeah.
And it was just assumed that somebody had named it that other than the map maker.
Exactly. The map maker, basically, who drew the outlines of the coast, put his name on the land found, and everybody said, okay, it's America.
America sounds good to us. Yeah, so we'll go there. But again, Chuck, it's just another example of the, I think, fault lines in our culture. Do I believe that there are some legitimate things that the overall Western European culture has ignored or taken for granted or tried to sugarcoat in history? Of course. Just like indigenous peoples have tried to sugarcoat or emotionalize much in their history as well. I mean, it's just that's the nature of the human beast, is to make it be as good for you or as tragic for you as possibly can in order to elicit sympathy or support.
Well, okay.
It's the old saying that the victor writes the histories.
Yeah, think about it in these terms. I live smack in the middle of Adena and Hopewell country here. We have mounds here. There's a couple of two or three different places where there are mounds, and every once in a while somebody finds a place that had a mound on their property, didn't know it. That kind of thing. Well, what happened to the mound builders? And if you ask that of an anthropologist who essentially is putting things mildly because he loves the whole native culture and all that, he will say that those tribes were subsumed by other tribes. What does subsumed mean? It means conquered.
I was going to say it means conquered.
Yes. So aside from being the disease-free, idyllic, peaceful, no worries kind of place...
And I honestly would like to see meet the person who actually believes that.
Believe me, they're out there.
They're out there, and I know. Okay, folks, you know what? It's like much of the stuff, and we're going to talk about some of this later, much of the conspiracy theory that spins around some of the events that happened this last week. People will believe almost anything if it sounds plausible, and this whole idea of it being a disease-free, peaceful, idyllic, everybody living in harmony kind of Eden or Nirvana before Columbus and explorers showed up to wreck everything. Okay, you know what? You're showing a lot of naivete, if that's the case.
Oh, absolutely. It's always interesting. You know, you talk to people like Tom DeWeese from the American Policy Center, and he's been taken out. He travels all over the country. He went out west, and somebody said, you see those marks on that cliff over there? They took him up to a cliff top. He said, yeah. He goes, that's where the Indians used to drive an entire herd of buffalo over the cliff, and their horns would hit the other side there. It was a narrow gap, and as they'd herd them over the cliff, and then they'd all be dead at the bottom, and then they'd go pick the parts off they wanted and leave the rest to rot. So this idea that the Native Americans were somehow in tune with their environment and didn't waste anything and blah, 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 this is nonsense. They did what they needed to do to survive, and the rest was left for the coyotes and possums and whatever else was out there on the plains. Wolves and things. So, you know, we get this idea of this idyllic thing, and that's the problem. We build images in our head. And how often do people build images in their head, and when they don't turn out to be true, they snap?
Well, I think history's replete with that kind of situation. The capacity for self-delusion in human beings is almost infinite, I think.
Oh, well, yeah. I think that's obvious.
Especially without the settling and the centering aspect of Christ and the Holy Spirit. Even Scripture says that clearly. Jeremiah says that the heart of man is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it?
Well, what
so, is... that's a lot of truth there. Without the change of our hearts by the salvation of Christ and the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, we as Calvinists talk about this whole idea of tulip, and the first thing's total depravity, and of course people get all up in arms about that. Well, we're not saying that you're as possibly bad as you can be. We're saying that without Christ, there's no limit to how bad you might become.
Well,
how depraved you could be, how completely given over to evil you may descend.
And that's utter depravity,
That's utter depravity. Total depravity means that there's nothing good in you, that is, you know, meritorious or earns you salvation, because that's all of Christ. We can't earn, so we can't work our way there. We can't, you know, we can't do all these good deeds and have all these great vibes and thoughts and get into heaven because, well, we were just nicer than the next person down the street. Our humanity is marred by sin in every molecule, and therefore we need the cleansing power of the blood of Christ to take away that stain, that sin. And without it, oh, we may do what would be subjectively considered good things. I mean, there are a lot of good people. Nobody stopped to ask some of the folks who sheltered people from the you know, barrage of hail of fire that was coming down upon them in Las Vegas, whether or not they were saved or not saved. People did things out of the goodness of their hearts, and we use that phrase, and I kind of laugh as I said it, because that's really kind of a misnomer as well. That's sort of like the, you know, everybody, there was no disease, and there was all indigenous people. The goodness of our hearts. Our hearts are not good. Scripture's clear. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked without Christ. And so, you know, we really have to start thinking about it. But, you know, I kind of took you off on a segue here. But let's run back to what you were talking about, which is the fact that you have people who, when things don't turn out the way they expect them because they've created expectations or this fantasy world in their head of how everything should be. And funny, Chuck, how these fantasies work, that in those fantasies, these people don't ever do any wrong, and they're always, you know, either the victim or the victor, one of the two. But those fantasies don't tend to work out because, well, real life happens, and real life is full of ups and downs and small victories and you know, defeats that may feel crushing at time but are actually minor. And, you know, in God's good providence, oftentimes he uses those things to help strengthen us and prepare us for the next battle that's coming along. So, you know, if we have hope in Christ, then we also have hope that even if something goes bad, there's always another thing coming that we can use. We can be strengthened in our faith. We can have hope, and that there's victory in Christ. But people who ignore Christ, reject Christ, out and out hate God, don't have that.
Oh, absolutely, they don't. In fact, you know, you went to the Old Testament when you were discussing this thing. I went to the New Testament. What did Paul say in Romans 1? For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For mm-hmm. what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal men and birds and animals and creeping things. This is part of that whole thing that I was talking about, this worship of things like indigenous populations. Again, as you stated, were the indigenous populations here given proper treatment? Well, not toward the end. They certainly were not. When you've got guys like William T. Sherman saying things like, the only good Indian is a dead Indian, and that kind of thing, it's pretty clear mm-hmm. that he has, and William T. Sherman was not noted for his belief system. He was one of those guys who considered himself a quote-unquote free thinker. This is kind of what happens when you become a thinker. You disconnect yourself from the reality of God and his requirements and his morality. And you begin to take on a more of a pragmatic approach to ethics and morality. And that's kind of the thing we're seeing. You know, we ran a program a few weeks ago called it's bizarre out there, and there's a reason for that, and we're sort of rehashing that territory because it needs to be rehashed from time to time. We are right now living in an extremely evil age, and when I say that, I say it with the full knowledge that I understand why what evil is, I think, at least within the limited parameters God has given me. I understand what evil is. Does anybody really else? When people say things like a certain act is evil, what do they really mean, Barry?
They really mean that they don't like it and it makes them uncomfortable, and there's this mask and veneer of respectability of society that they feel has been violated or abrogated in these incidences, and in many cases that's a legitimate feeling. But evil is really the absence of God.
Yes, and that's really the problem.
What it gets down to.
How do you have evil? How do you have the concept of evil when you do not acknowledge the existence of God? Because evil then becomes a consensus thing. Well, society says that's evil, and therefore it's evil. Or if it's evil, if it's evil in my eyes, then that's what evil is. And even though it may not be evil in someone else's eyes, there are all kinds of things going on right now that you and I would consider evil, and other people wouldn't.
Well, and again, you know, if you don't have an absolute standard based upon the God who is there, and you base it upon your own feelings and your own thoughts as man, then you're going to end up with a slippery standard that's going to keep devolving over time. I mean, think about this, Chuck. We went from the biblical admonitions against killing and against adultery and fornication, and nowadays we have abortion, we have no-fault divorce, we have homosexuality being lifted up and positioned in an equal level with heterosexual marriage. We have the celebration of gender dysphoria. And those things are because man has determined in himself that these are good. At least some men, and they've been oppressed and cajoled and used propaganda to change the culture, because the culture is not moored in an absolute unchanging standard of right and wrong, good and evil, which is the only way you can have those things is with the understanding of the God who created us and who sustains us and who superintends all of our affairs. And when you reject God, he turns you over, as Romans 1 says there, turns you over to a reprobate mind.
Yes,
where darkness becomes light, and light becomes darkness, good becomes evil, and evil becomes good, and therefore everything's out of whack. Because once that happens, then and we see it, we talk about it all the time, Chuck, and many people do, and they just don't realize that it's really just an absence of God. When they talk about government being out of control or being tyrannical, well, all that is a complete twisting of Romans 13, because the civil magistrate's appointed by God, and he's supposed to be there to what? To reward good and to punish evil.
Yeah.
But if we don't have any standard for what good and evil are, and it's not based on the absolute standard of God's word, where he's showed us what is good and what is evil, and he's spelled it out for us, and we reject that and say, no, well, we think those things over there that you didn't like, you're just being too harsh, or these things over here that you do like, we don't want to show any favoritism to any one religion. What do you get? You get a devolving standard. You get societal change, which leads to societal chaos, which leads to societal disintegration.
Well, okay.
And we've seen it. We've seen it happen in history. So we're not immune to that here in this day and age, in this culture.
Yeah, you're speaking about the government attempting to be, that intellectuals and the government attempting to be quote-unquote neutral on religion. And you and I always laugh about that because, as Van Til made clear, there is no such thing as neutrality. Basically, what you do is you eschew established ideas of faith and religion, and you replace them with a counterfeit, that in which you attempt to create an amalgam of all kinds of faith views and moralities and ethics, and you try to mix them all up, and what you find is very often is that you have an amalgam of things that don't make a good mix, that don't, and in fact don't work. So you try to cut things out, and what you end up doing is things like, well, you actually have people who will argue that abortion or some kind of infanticide or euthanasia and the murder of the old and all kinds of things are in fact moral and ethical. Well, how can you do that? The only way to do that is to separate out from the idea of absolute standards and go to a community standard. A communal standard in which people the consensus agrees. This is the argument that you're going to get from atheists, that our morality has evolved from the needs of society. This is what you'll hear from people like Richard Dawkins, who is a militant atheist, and a quote unquote scientist. What you'll hear is essentially the idea that somehow this has all evolved. Now, what happens if you create a society in which murder's okay, robbery and rape are just fine, theft? How well do those kind of societies function?
Not very well at all.
No, they don't at all.
I'm not even sure you can call it society at that point.
Well, yes. It's chaos, essentially. Because everybody simply, from each according to his needs, from each according to his means, to each according to his needs, which, by the way, is the shorthand version of what communism is. And some people say, well, what's wrong with that? Well, what's wrong with that is it requires theft.
Yes.
We all know that Hugh Hefner died here just recently. There are great articles out there, if you want to read about this, about someone who essentially eschewed quote unquote old tired ethics in favor of a new ethic. But if you look at Hugh Hefner's new ethic, it was all based on himself. What was good for Hugh? Of course, after he's dead, now people are coming out because, you know, once he is dead, he's no longer powerful. And people were coming out and saying some of the things that he was doing. You know, he was surrounding himself with these beautiful young women who apparently weren't beautiful enough. He would send them out for enhancement surgery. And in the early days, those enhancements were kind of dangerous. They've gotten a lot better, but for instance, breast enhancement, the bags would break open and the women would become extremely ill, and he'd send them to the hospital. If that happened, he'd send them to the hospital and have the new reduction done. He was done with these women. I mean, that those kinds of stories are starting to come out. There's a great article in the Aquila Report, speaking ill of Hugh Hefner, that only prudish Christians and spoil sport feminists are willing to say that the man was obviously wicked and destructive, is itself a reminder that the rot Hugh Hefner spread goes very, very deep. That's it. Hugh Hefner created a new morality and a new ethic, and here's where we are.
Well, and let's not kid ourselves. He did not create a new morality. He rejected the existing morality.
Yeah.
That's really all he did. He's not creating anything because, well, frankly, you know, he can't. God's the only creative force in the universe. Man recreates, or we reject and reshape, or try to at least, and we fail. I mean, the result of Hugh Hefner's new morality is rises in STDs, the advance of the homosexual movement, the objectification of women, the spawning and rise of, you know, a massive pornography industry, human trafficking, increased drug usage. The list goes on and on and on and on. That's what happens when we decide to reject God. When we reject his moral standards, that's what we should expect. And think about it, Chuck. When did Hefner release the first issue of Playboy?
1955, I think.
Yeah, I think it was. It might have been 53 or 55, one of the two.
Somewhere in there, yeah.
Okay, so basically in 60 years, generation and a half, and we look at how that new morality has shaped our culture. I mean, why are we now passing laws to basically put kids, and I mean little kids, in jail because they're sending nude pictures of themselves or their friends via social media? You know, why do we have situations where we have young kids contracting STDs? Why do we have situations where, you know, every day, you know, you hear about some new atrocity going on? And Chuck, let's just go there. Almost every day now, you're seeing somewhere across this country where a teacher is being jailed and stripped of licensure for having sex with their students. That's Hugh Hefner's new morality.
And what's strange about that is, Barry, it used to be more of a male phenomenon. In other words...
Oh, and yeah, now it's strongly a female phenomenon.
Exactly. It's feminism run amok. Essentially, you know, it used to be a male teacher would become obsessed with a girl in his class, and he would maybe abscond with her or have an affair with her or whatever. And now it has gone over the arrests we're hearing about. Now, it may just be that the male things are handled, you know, it's not quite as sensational. So therefore, you know, it's the old story about what leads in a newspaper. Dog bites man isn't a story. Man bites dog is always the big lead because it's so odd.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be the case. But the fact is we're seeing over and over and over, almost weekly, a case where usually a young and attractive female is having a, you know, seducing these boys in their class. And let's face it, high school boys, how tough are they to seduce?
Well, again, and then that gets back to the Hugh Hefner culture. How many of those boys probably spend time on their social media or on their self or internet browsing or anything else watching hardcore pornography? You know, it's the big prevalence, and you know, because you sit on the board of a organization that goes into the schools to try to teach kids how to have safe and healthy relationships. That the prevalence of the advancement of a certain sexual act among teenagers is becoming epidemic. And that is, and a friend of ours, Elizabeth Johnston, over at the Activist Mommy, actually created a national firestorm over objecting to a magazine called Teen Vogue putting out a guide to anal sex.
Yeah.
Teenagers. Vote, okay?
Yeah.
Teenagers. Basically trying to normalize sodomy. Chuck, that's where we're at. These kids, that's the right. That sexual practice is like upticking in huge numbers among teenagers who see it in pornography and then want to experiment with it. And, you know, it's welcome to Hugh Hefner's new morality. And of course, you know, like you said, these teenage boys, and it's not just boys, because there are some instances where it's there are female teachers with girls as well.
Yeah.
And there are male teachers with both girls and guys engaging in illicit, but it's becoming almost every day now, Chuck, when I open my media, somewhere in some newspaper in some corner of the country, there's another teacher going up for licensure revocation or for jail time for carrying on illicit activities with students or contacting them through social media and trying to groom them or sending them, you know, obscene pictures or trying to set up dates, etc., with kids. There's just one happened here close at a school just over in Lawrence County next door to us. Two different school employees within a week of each other have both been suspended and probably will get fired and may go to jail for what they call illicit communications with a student.
You gotta love the euphemism.
The euphemistic way we have to frame this, because, you know, that's the other thing. It's sort of like the Victorian era, Chuck. We still have this air of we really don't want to talk about these things in respectable society, but we're watching them explode into respectable society because we won't say anything about it. I mean, that's really, you know, that's the disease is spreading because nobody wants to talk about the disease. You know, it becomes the thing that, well, you know, we really don't want to say anything about that, but that's what's going on. That's Hugh Hefner's new morality. Now, you know, we talk about this because part of that new morality, Chuck, is that life is cheap. It's only for the fulfillment of our deeply held self-interest. I mean, why does a teacher bet a student? Because he or she believes that somehow they will be more fulfilled emotionally, spiritually, sexually, whatever, with a young person rather than the person they're married to. And the vast majority of these female teachers, they're married women with kids.
Yes.
With kids of their own. But they're dissatisfied because it's not fulfilling to them. And why is it not fulfilling? Because they've been drilled into their heads time and time again through romance literature, movies like 50 Shades of Grey, the Vogue, the magazines, Cosmopolitan, Vogue, blah, 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 that it's all about the next sensation. It's all about having that emotional buzz, that high. That's the ultimate goal. Chuck, we're living in the brave new world that Aldous Huxley wrote about in his dystopian novel back in the 50s. It's all about, remember the two things that the culture was kept in check with? Sex.
And drugs.
And drugs.
Yeah.
What do we have now? We have an explosion of sexuality and we have an explosion of drug abuse in use all over our country. And especially here in Ohio and in rural areas, suburban areas, urban core areas, and in farm fields, we're seeing the rise of drug use and abuse and rampant sexual consequences. I mean, STD rates going up. You have all kinds of things of that nature.
Well, I think about it. My wife and I were just talking because something came up about hepatitis C. She said, you know, do you realize that they're recommending that everyone who was born between 1945 and 1965 be tested for hep C? And I said, yeah. I said, it's a sexually transmitted disease in some cases, and in other things, it's blood transfusions and other things. And we were talking about that, and she was, you know, more on the it can be passed along from mother to offspring. And she was like, "Are they saying it goes back? You know, it goes back around, you know, the time of the war?" And I said, "Well, sure, of course." You're thinking in terms of birth. I'm thinking in terms of the fact that we've lived in anybody born between 1945 and 1965 was in smack in the middle of the sexual revolution, the quote unquote sexual revolution. What does that mean? Well, that means sex, drugs, rock and roll. The assumption is that you know, you probably engaged in premarital sex and some kind of drug use and, well, of course, rock and roll. You almost can't avoid that. But not that I'm saying I would. You should see my record collection. But it's not just parent to child. It's sharing needles. It's sex with multiple partners. That's the deal. And this is, again, that's the Hugh Hefner influence generation. I mean, and again, I would suggest maybe we'll put a link up to this, that article in the Aquila report. It's very good. And we should think about these things. Have we been led down the primrose path by the idea of we can do all these things that feel really good for a short time? And then what happens? See, that's the part we don't think about when we get lured into these things. The people that have sex with children, the adults having sex with children, and yes, folks, high schoolers are still children. As anybody, you talk to developmental psychologists, and boy, I'll tell you this: car rental companies know this. You aren't really fully developed in the way you think until you're about 25 years old.
Right, your frontal lobe doesn't completely develop until you're 25.
Yeah.
we say that people, say sometimes that kids just only have half a brain. Well, it's not quite half, but the point is that it's underdeveloped.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And talking about underdeveloped brains, I kind of want to segue here because I know we're going to cut short on time, and this is a very important thing we need to talk about. Everybody's attention is focused right now on what happened this week in Las Vegas, where you had a individual, at least an individual, of course, and we'll get around to the idea of why, you have to be careful about what kind of information you take in. But we had an individual who, for whatever reasons, and we're not sure yet, and I think the motives are still being figured out and police are unsure, decided that it would fulfill him in some way to basically indiscriminately try to kill as many people as he possibly could. We're still trying to figure all this out. Now, Chuck, you and I, we held off for a while trying to, before recording this program today, because we were trying to figure out, okay, is there stuff that's going to come out? Is there a gotcha that's going to come out here anytime soon here? What's going to be happening with this? And what we've come to find out is that there's about as little information now as there was in the immediate hours after the shooting happened. We do have a couple of things, and if you go over to some of the online news media, they are looking at this whole thing about Stephen Paddock. Now, Stephen Paddock is an individual, a 64-year-old individual, who checked into the Mandalay Bay Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, who took a room on the 32nd floor, and who at some point during his stay managed to bring in and set up in his room what they're calling a sniper's nest. Supposedly had 23 firearms, but Chuck, the more I look at that, the more I'm wondering, okay, can you show me the list of firearms that were in the room? Because I'm guessing you're counting certain accessories
as firearms. Yeah.
And because it doesn't make any sense. I mean, think about that. Just, this whole idea about, it was idyllic, peaceful, and there was no disease, that this one individual man by himself could have brought in 23 basically high-powered or high-capacity weapons.
I was under the impression that the number had been cut to 16 or 17.
That the initials were 23, and that they found 19 at his home later, when he searched his home. But then you've got like videos of the media interviewing a family member, his brother, who lives, I think, in Florida, basically saying that the guy really, didn't have any interest in guns or anything of that nature. So it's like, really? Okay. Some of this stuff's not making sense.
Right.
But basically what he did is that he went to the Mandalay Bay Hotel, and on some of these websites there's an interesting graphic of the fact that from the point of his hotel, he had a bird's eye view, so to speak, of this outdoor concert venue that was taking place about 1,200 in the distance from his room area to the where the concert was being held, the grounds, was about 1,200 feet. But that's at an angle. He's 32 stories up, so you know, 1,200 feet down to the ground. So, and that, and of course, there's a, in the Las Vegas Review Journal today, Chuck, there is a argument that they found a couple of bullet holes in tanks that are about 2,000 feet away, that were filled or supposedly filled with jet fuel.
Well, okay, if you ever have flown into McCarran Airport. In Las Vegas, the Mandalay Bay is right there. I mean, it's really, really close to the airport. It's very, very obviously close. So I've always wondered about that. I've always thought, gosh, what if something bad would happen? You know, there are all kinds of bad things you can think about when you, well, I was just in Las Vegas at McCarran Airport. So again, I was thinking about it relatively, recently. But I, you know, there it, the thing is surrounded by. It's not too far. You can also see. What's the hotel that's like a big black pyramid?
The Luxor.
The Luxor. You can see. You can see. I think. What is it? New York. New York. They're all right there, real close to the airport. You know, convenient. Fly in. Take a cab over to. Hole up in a Las Vegas hotel and lose your yearly salary.
Which you know, now that you brought that up, that seems to be one of the things that has come out that's been fairly, I think, well reported, and I mean that they've actually verified it, that the individual Mr. Paddock was a regular visitor to casinos, that he was very enamored of video poker, and that they're roughly trying to calculate that he potentially was spending up to $30,000 per day on video poker. Now, Chuck, I'm sorry, I can't spend $300 on any kind of gambling and not have it impact my budget.
I couldn't spend $300 a month and not have it.
A day, month, year, I mean, you name it, I couldn't do that. But somehow this man had an interesting, I mean, he had access to a lot of money. Somebody said he was a real estate, there are reports he was a real estate investor, blah, blah, blah. He owned a $400,000 home in a community in a town outside of Las Vegas called Mesquite. So
Mesquite, yeah. What I'm hearing now is that he was a retired accountant for a big defense contractor.
Well, gee, I didn't realize that accountants for defense contractors got paid millions of dollars a year in retirement because... I mean, and then obviously, yeah, he could have had other sources of income. They still haven't, like, determined all that yet. But at some point, he decided, in and of himself, supposedly, and of course we say that because we don't know what the real situation is, because they do know that he checked into the Mandalay Bay Hotel on September the 28th, and he opened fire on October the 1st. So that's 3 days later. But supposedly, according to some reports from interviews with hotel staff, the hotel staff who would go in and out of the room, you know, the maids and things doing the cleaning and stuff, saw nothing out of the ordinary. So there weren't, you know, piles of weaponry and ammunition stacked in the closets or in the corners. There was no, you know, sniper's nests, you know, built up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's an awful lot that's still laid out to a lot of questions.
Barry, there's almost no questions answered. The FBI has been, and through the sheriff, has been saying they have pretty strong inclination that he was not alone and that he had help. Why did this fellow send $100,000 to the Philippines? And if he's got a $30,000, you know, per any period gambling problem, how did he have $100,000 to send to the Philippines? And who did he send it to?
Well, see, now that's the thing. Now, again, you know, more will come out, and he may have had access to quite a bit of money. You never know. I mean, if he was a real estate investor, he might have struck it rich by selling, you know, a strip of land or something that they want to build a new casino on. You never know about that stuff. It may come out. But the sending the $100,000 to the Philippines, well, you know, he had a girlfriend, this lady by the name of Marilou Danley, who is Filipino.
Yeah.
And who, 2 weeks before the shooting, had left to go to the Philippines for a visit. And so the question might have been, he may have just been transferring $100,000 over to her for her expenses.
Oh, my gosh. What kind of expenses do you have that you need $100,000? Okay,
you know, I can't necessarily bat an eye at that, because I have some familiarity through, you know, social media of seeing some folks who have got lots of money and who are, you know, make trips to the Philippines all the time and seem to be spending lots and lots of money there. So, you know, it isn't like basically outside the realm of possibility. Because I know of an example. So it's kind of strange, but I do know of an example of that. But now we're looking at this situation that, okay, so he opened fire on this crowd that was attending a country concert. Basically, it was like a big jamboree thing, and the closing act was Jason Aldean, and basically the firing started happening, and the band kind of thought they stopped for a second and they started playing again. And about 10 seconds later, they realized, as they started seeing people dropping, that somebody was firing on them. So they all hightailed it off the stage. People went flying hither, thither, and yon. And of course, at the end of it, and probably isn't over with yet, because, you know, there's still people who are in critical condition, that 59 individuals lost their lives that night due to the actions of Stephen Paddock. Now, whether or not all 59 of those people were shot by Paddock and died as a result of being shot, we don't know, because, you know, there's no clear breakdown. And of course, all 59 will be attributed to, you know, him. But a number of those people, some of them could have been because they were crushed in the ensuing panic of 21,000 people who were jammed into this this field, basically, to watch this country concert, all breaking out as they were realizing that they were being fired upon. And some people could have gotten stomped, crushed, you know, stampeded, and killed that way. You could have had people who had heart conditions who may have, the stress of that was too much, and that killed them. We won't know.
Oh, yeah.
We really won't know how much this is happening. Now, what we do know is, it takes a pretty good shot, Chuck, to sit in a room on a 32nd floor of a hotel and fire basically all the way across a street. And if you look at the thing he was firing, basically there was the Mandalay sets on a corner. This concert venue sits on another corner, and there's like an intersection between the two of them. And there's buildings and materials that are down toward the floor, and of course, including the stage, that he would have had to have fired over around. I mean, he could have done it, but it really takes to, if you actually hit that many people with a gun, you've had some experience firing weapons.
Okay, the way I would look at it. Depends how closely they were packed. And who knows? I don't know anything about the venue. So if they were packed really closely, and you really didn't care what you hit,
well, sure. I mean, you just wanted spray, but I mean,
that's
even so.
But if you have heard recordings, that's what it sounded like he did. He just opened up and sprayed bullets down on this group. And apparently, like hundreds. And hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rounds. So obviously, because now people are close packed closely enough, you one bullet from say a 30 caliber, you know, a 7.62x39 or some grade weapon like that could easily pass through one person and go into another.
Oh, it could very well. And we have no idea to this point in time.
None whatsoever.
What the guns were he was using. So.
Yeah, exactly. I can guess, but again, we don't know. And if you heard it, he apparently was using either an automatic weapon or, as they've accused, a bump stock. And if you're using a bump stock, you don't care what you hit, because there is no way to accurately fire a sniper fashion with a bump stock. I have not fired one. I've seen them fired. Frankly, they're not in the slightest attractive to me. However, the idea that somehow they should be banned because someone used one, that's a slippery slope. That's like basically saying, well, guns kill people and therefore they should be banned. Well, cars kill people, drugs kill people, all kinds of things kill people, and they're not banned. They're simply regulated. And the fact is, if Nevada wanted to ban bump stocks in their state, hey, it's Nevada. If it's within their constitutional parameters, then they should do what they feel is necessary. Should we do that at the federal level? Of course not, because the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment doesn't say anything about rate of fire, caliber size, magazine size, blah, 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 and then you can infringe the right to keep and bear arms. No. It says, shall not be infringed without qualification. Therefore, it is a it is in fact a state issue, not a federal issue. And it was all
but you know that progressive liberals, including Hillary Clinton, have immediately, even before it seems like even before, you know, passing condolences along to the individuals and families who were affected by the shooting, were immediately out there crying for gun control and taking guns away and banning all sorts of weapons. And And of course, you're right. This bump stock thing, which I honestly just saw a picture of one. I've never seen one before. I frankly think it'd be clunky and kind of stupid. That'd be something I wouldn't want to put on any of my firearms. But you know, they're wanting to scream out, and of course, you've got a bunch of weak-kneed Republicans. And I guess I just saw something this morning. John Cornyn in Texas is now warming up to the idea of, oh, well, let's ban bump stocks.
That's a compromise position, Barry. That is what they're gearing up to do. They'll ban bump stocks with a sunset provision, and just to make everybody see we did something. You cannot stop someone who has evil in his brain. Now, they're now talking about that this fellow was on a drug, a behavioral kind of drug, for depression or something. And he's in a significant number of people, it causes a form of sort of paranoia. Well, for crying out loud, why wasn't this guy being monitored if he's on a drug that causes paranoia? Some of these things just my gun is dangerous because someone might go on a drug that causes paranoia and causes them to do dumb things. It's like the Texas school book, the Texas University tower shooter.
Right.
Now, obviously, you probably don't remember this case because you would have been really, really, really little.
Probably not.
I barely remember it, because I was 9 years old, I think. But this fellow went up in the tower at the University of Texas with a rifle and randomly shot. He wasn't spraying bullets like this guy in Mandalay Bay, but he randomly shot students as they walked past this tower. Killed several people, and in the end, I think he ended up killing himself just like this guy. It turned out when they did the autopsy, he had a brain tumor.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, I shouldn't be allowed to own a gun because someone could get a brain tumor. This doesn't make any sense, Barry. What caused this guy to snap? That's the real question. What caused this guy to go off the deep end with a $30,000 a week or whatever gambling habit? What if he was really, really deeply in debt and had been on a grand losing streak? I mean, this guy would take up residence in gambling casinos for weeks at a time. This is not the first time he did. You know, he lived in a gambling casino and not in his home in Mesquite. He was what was known as a high roller. Now, I actually saw a headline where somebody in Las Vegas said, well, he had the profile of a responsible gambler. Barry, there is no such thing as a responsible gambler.
Oh, well, but again, Chuck, in their morality, yes, there is. Because
exactly.
You can be a good person and you know, gamble away your money.
What if this person snapped because of his gambling debts that sent him over the edge? Yeah.
You're not supposed to talk about that.
Yeah. Why are we not talking about banning gambling?
Well, because there's too big of an industry around it. And you know what? It gets right down to it. Again, it's where your heart motive is. Now, Chuck, I want, you know, before we close out here, I want to make a note here, and I don't want to diminish or belittle any way the tragedy that this was in Las Vegas. And, you know, but we're going to spend weeks and weeks of media headlines and analysis and talking heads trying to determine and grieving over the 59 people who lost their lives during this tragic event. But yet, we need to put it in perspective here in Ohio, because, and this is another thing, the State Department of Health just announced their abortion statistics for 2016.
This is Ohio State.
And there's,
yeah.
This is Ohio. And that, yes, yay, abortions are down by 1% in Ohio over the previous year, which means we went from 21,000 and some to 20,000 and some. But it really still means that every day in Ohio, 57 unborn, defenseless children are slaughtered in the womb. Now, every day, Chuck, 57. But for a one-time event with someone who's taking morality into their own hands and firing down on a crowd of unsuspecting people, defenseless people, we'll spend weeks, if not months, if not years, talking over it, eulogizing the fallen, discussing the motives, looking for answers and solutions. But we completely ignore, and the media specifically completely ignores, by design and intentionally, the fact that every single day, 57 of our fellow citizens are cut down and don't have and can't defend themselves.
And that's just in Ohio.
I mean, the numbers nationwide, I mean, if you figure there's 20,000 plus in Ohio, there are over, I think Planned Parenthood alone does over 360,000 abortions a year. You know, if you figure out that's 1,000
a day. Yeah.
Across the country.
Okay. The questions are going to come up.
And again, Chuck, this is also a result of our new morality we talked about earlier.
Yeah, exactly.
Because sex shouldn't have any consequences, according to the Hefner morality.
Big hunk of the Playboy philosophy.
And gambling shouldn't have any consequences, according to that philosophy of being a responsible gambler. But you know what? Life interferes with that, and there are consequences.
That's right.
And some of those consequences are people die. And people die because we refuse to follow the wisdom and the protection of God's morality, of God's revealed word.
And if you're going to question whether we're drawing direct parallels between a shooter who shoots randomly and murders people and an abortionist, yes, we're
absolutely drawing that parallel.
We're drawing that parallel.
If I was too subtle, I apologize.
Yes, well, you're forgiven because you weren't all that subtle. I don't necessarily connect the dots here. I'll connect them for you.
Exactly.
Well, that being said, we are out of time. And now you know what we think, and we want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. Has contact information for Barry and I, and also show archives. So you can go out there to contact us. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.